The glass partition slides shut with a sound like a blade finding its sheath. It is a precise, expensive noise that swallows the hum of the open plan office, leaving only the sound of my own breathing and the soft, rhythmic clicking of Claire's keyboard. She doesn't look up. She doesn't need to. The silence in this room isn't an absence of noise. It is a pressurized weight, a vacuum waiting for me to fill it with the right words. I am standing 3 feet from her desk, holding a manila folder that feels heavier than the laptop in my bag. The air in here is 4 degrees cooler than the hallway. It smells of expensive lilies and the ozone of high-end air purifiers. "You've always been the one who sees the variables before they collide." That's what she told me 6 months ago when she moved my desk into the executive suite. It felt like an observation, a compliment, tailored to my specific brand of competence. Now, looking at the grainy printout tucked inside the folder, the one showing the time-stamped exit of a junior associate from a hotel room that Claire's corporate card paid for, the compliment feels more like a blueprint, a map of how she intended to use me. Fixing problems quietly is a skill. It is a discreet, professional talent that earns you 6 figures and a title that sounds like leadership. But as I watch the way the light catches the sharp silver edge of her privacy screen, I realize that silence isn't just a professional courtesy. It's a mortgage. The associate is 23. His name is Julian, and he has the kind of wide-eyed, institutional belief in meritocracy that makes him easy to dismantle. He's been calling my personal line for 3 hours. I haven't answered. I am waiting for Claire to tell me which version of the truth we are buying today. She finally stops typing. She leans back, her chair pivoting with a fluid, silent grace, and she looks at me, not with guilt, or even with the frantic energy of someone who has been caught, but with a terrifying, serene expectation. She looks at me the way a captain looks at a navigator when the clouds turn black. She isn't asking for help. She is waiting for me to report that the problem has already been solved. "It's about the integrity of the firm," she says. Her voice is a low, steady alto, the kind of voice that commands rooms without ever rising in volume. She doesn't mention the hotel. She doesn't mention the fact that Julian was seen crying in the lobby. She talks about the quarterly audit. She talks about the sensitivity of the upcoming merger. She frames the entire sordid afternoon as a lapse in Julian's judgment. A young man who couldn't handle the pressure, who looked for a connection in the wrong places, and who might now, in his confusion, try to blame the very person who tried to mentor him. It's a beautiful piece of architecture. She builds a world where she is the victim of his instability, and she hands me the hammer to drive the final nails into the frame. I could walk out. The thought sits in the back of my mind like a ghost. I could drop the folder on her mahogany desk, turn around and walk through that glass door. But then I think about the mortgage on the condo I bought in October. I think about the recommendation letter she promised for the board seat I've been chasing for 3 years. I think about the way the Canadian housing market swallows people who don't have institutional protection. The leverage isn't a threat she has made out loud. It's the sheer weight of the life I've built with her help. If she falls, the floor of my life isn't just removed, it's vaporized. I find myself nodding. It is a small, almost imperceptible movement. But the moment I do it, the pressure in the room shifts. The vacuum is gone. The air is breathable again. Claire smiles, and it's the warmest thing I've seen all day. It's the smile of a mother who has just seen her child pass a difficult test. She tells me that Julian needs a soft landing, but a distant one. She suggests a generous severance package, contingent on a comprehensive non-disclosure agreement. She suggests that I be the one to deliver it, because I have a rapport with him, because I'm the approachable face of the executive tier. I am the one who will sit across from a 23-year-old boy in a sterile conference room. I am the one who will look him in the eye and tell him that his career isn't over. It's just transitioning. I am the one who will slide the pen toward him and explain that managing the fallout is just a part of the professional world he was so eager to join. I am the enabler. But as I watch Claire return to her emails, I realize she has outsourced more than just the dirty work. She has outsourced the shame. By the time I leave her office, I am no longer an observer of the crime. I am the architect of the cover-up. And I am telling myself, with a terrifying calm logic, that I am doing it for the good of the firm. The hallway is bright, the fluorescent lights reflecting off the polished marble floors with a clinical intensity. Every step I take toward the HR wing feels like a deliberate choice to ignore the vibration of my phone in my pocket. Julian is calling again. I stop by the water station, pressing the button and watching the clear, cold stream fill a paper cup. My hands are steady. That is the most frightening part. There is no trembling, no sudden rush of adrenaline. There is only the cold, hard competence of a woman who knows exactly how to make a problem disappear. I am not the victim here. I am the person who makes sure the victim stays quiet. And for that service, I will be rewarded with a seat at the table where the next set of victims will be chosen. I walk into the conference room. It's a glass box suspended over the city, a transparent cage. Julian is already there. He looks smaller than he did in the hotel footage. He looks like someone who hasn't slept in 48 hours, his tie slightly askew, his eyes red-rimmed. When he sees me, a look of profound relief washes over his face. He thinks I'm here to save him. He thinks I'm the one person in this building who will tell him the truth. I sit down across from him, placing the folder on the table between us. I don't open it. Not yet. I just look at him with a practiced, empathetic tilt of the head. "I'm so glad it's you," he whispers. His voice cracks, a small, fragile sound in the vast silence of the room. He starts to talk, the words tumbling out in a frantic, disorganized rush. He talks about the drinks after the conference, about how Claire told him he had infinite potential, about how she made him feel like he was the only person in the world who understood the vision she had for the firm. He talks about the hotel room, how it felt like a dream until the door clicked shut and the power dynamic shifted so violently he felt sick. He is looking for a witness. He is looking for someone to say, "Yes, I saw it too. Yes, she did this." I let him finish. I wait for the silence to return, for the air to settle. I don't look away. I don't blink. I let the silence stretch until he starts to shift in his chair, until the relief on his face turns back into a sharp, jagged anxiety. Then I speak. My voice is soft, professional, and utterly devoid of the judgment he is looking for. I tell him that I've looked at the logs. I tell him that the firm has a very strict policy regarding the use of corporate resources for personal encounters. I tell him that Claire is deeply disappointed, but that she wants to make sure he isn't ruined by this lapse in judgment. He stares at me. The confusion is so thick I can almost taste it. He asks me what I mean by personal encounter. I explain, with the patience of a teacher explaining a difficult concept, that from the perspective of an auditor, it looks as though he took advantage of a superior's hospitality. I suggest that any attempt to frame it otherwise would be seen as a desperate move by a junior employee facing termination for cause. I don't threaten him. I don't have to. I just describe the reality that has already been constructed around him. I show him the walls of the maze, and I show him the only door that is currently unlocked. "It's a severance package," I say, sliding the document toward him. "It's 3 times the standard amount. It's a clean break. No black marks on your record. A neutral reference. It's a fresh start, Julian. You're young. You have so much ahead of you. Why risk it all on a story that no one will believe?" He looks at the document. He looks at the pen. He looks at me. For a second, I see the recognition in his eyes. He sees the strings. He sees that I am the one pulling them. That I am the barrier between him and the person who actually hurt him. He realizes that I am not his ally. I am the person paid to make sure his pain doesn't cost the company money. He looks at the glass walls of the room, at the city sprawling out below us, at the sheer vertical drop of the world he is about to be pushed out of. And then he signs. The sound of the pen on the paper is a small scratching noise, like a mouse behind a wall. It is the sound of a future being traded for a temporary safety. When he finishes, he doesn't look at me. He just gets up and walks out of the room, leaving the signed document on the table. He moves like a ghost, silent and weightless. I stay in the room for a long time. I look at his signature, a messy, hurried scrawl that represents the end of his time here. I pick up the paper. It's cold. I walk back to Claire's office. The lights in the main area are beginning to dim as the cleaning crews start their rounds. The vacuum cleaners hum in the distance, a low industrial drone. I enter her office without knocking. She is standing by the window, looking out at the skyline. She doesn't turn around. She knows the sound of my footsteps. "Is it done?" she asks. "It's done," I reply. I place the signed agreement on her desk. She turns then, and the look she gives me is one of pure, unadulterated partnership. We are in this together now. We are the two people who know where the bodies are buried, because we are the ones who dug the holes. She walks over to the small bar in the corner of her office and pours two glasses of scotch. She hands one to me. The amber liquid catches the light, glowing like a low-burning fire. "To the future," she says, raising her glass. I raise mine. The crystal is heavy in my hand. The scotch is smooth, burning its way down my throat with a heat that feels like a cauterization. I don't feel guilty. I don't feel like a monster. I feel like a professional. I feel like someone who has earned her place at the top by understanding the true cost of power. The cost isn't what you do. It's what you're willing to make other people believe they did. As I finish my drink, I notice a small smudge of ink on my thumb, Julian's ink. I try to rub it off, but it has already set into the skin, a tiny dark mark that refuses to fade. Claire is talking now, something about the merger, something about the new office layout, but I am barely listening. I am looking at the glass partition, at the way my own reflection is superimposed over the city. I look competent. I look successful. I look like someone who is in control. But then I hear it. The snick of the privacy screen as Claire slides it shut again. It's the same noise as before. But this time, I am on the inside. I am in the cool, lily-scented air with the woman who knows exactly how much I am worth. And as the door locks, I realize that the most successful manipulations don't feel like a trap at all. They feel like a promotion. They feel like a seat at the table. They feel like the only logical choice in a world where the only other option is to fall. I set the glass down. The ice clinks against the side. A sharp, clear sound in the silence. Claire is watching me, her eyes bright with a predatory intelligence. She knows that I know. She knows that every time I look at my thumb, I will see Julian. And she knows that as long as I want to keep this office, this view, and this life, I will keep her secrets as if they were my own, because they are my own now. I have managed the fallout, and in doing so, I have become the very thing I was supposed to protect the company from. I am the fallout, and the fallout never leaves the room. The lilies are starting to wilt at the edges, a brown decay creeping into the white petals. I reach out and touch one, the surface cold and waxy. Claire is back at her desk, her fingers flying across the keys again. The rhythm is hypnotic, a steady, relentless heartbeat of industry. I walk toward the door, my hand on the silver handle. It doesn't move. For a second, a spike of panic flares in my chest, a sudden, irrational fear that I am trapped. Then I remember the new security protocols. I press my thumb against the biometric scanner. The light turns green. The lock disengages with a soft electronic beep, and the door opens. I walk out into the hallway, the cool air of the office following me like a shroud. I don't look back. I don't need to. I know that tomorrow there will be another problem to solve, another fire to extinguish, another person to silence. And I know that I will do it. I will do it because I am good at it. I will do it because I have nowhere else to go. I will do it. Because the most dangerous thing in the world isn't the person who breaks the rules. It's the person who makes sure the rules still look like they're being followed. I reach the elevators and press the button for the garage. The doors slide open, and I step inside the mirrored box. I look at myself. The suit is perfect. The hair is in place. The eyes are steady. I look like the picture of executive success. But as the elevator begins its descent, pulling the floor out from under me, I feel a sudden violent lurch in my stomach. It passes as quickly as it came, leaving behind only a dull, aching emptiness. I am going home to my beautiful condo, to my high-end appliances and my designer furniture. I am going home to the life that Claire helped me build. And as the doors open to the dark, quiet garage, I realize that the weight of the folder wasn't the evidence inside it. It was the price of the key to the executive suite, a price I have now paid in full. I find my car, the headlights cutting through the gloom as I unlock it. I sit in the driver's seat, the leather cold against my legs. I don't start the engine. I just sit there in the dark, listening to the silence of the concrete cavern. My phone vibrates in my bag. A text message from Claire. Excellent work today. Get some rest. We have a big week ahead. I don't reply. I just stare at the screen until it goes dark. The reflection of my own face staring back at me from the black glass. I am the one who fixes things. I am the one who stays quiet. I am the one who owns the fallout. And for the first time in my life, I realize that owning the fallout means you never get to be clean again. The drive home is a blur of streetlights and rain-slicked pavement. The city is a grid of light and shadow, a complex machine that never stops moving. I think about Julian. I wonder where he is now. If he's sitting in a bar somewhere, or if he's already packed his bags. I wonder if he hates me. I hope he does. Hate is a clean, honest emotion. It's more than I deserve. I pull into my parking spot, the engine ticking as it cools. The building is quiet, the lobby empty. The concierge nods to me as I pass, a silent acknowledgement of my status. I enter my apartment and drop my keys on the marble counter. The sound echoes in the empty space. I walk to the window and look out at the city. From up here, everything looks perfect. Everything looks managed. I reach out and touch the glass, my thumb resting on the cold surface. The ink is still there, a tiny dark ghost of a signature that wasn't mine. I close my eyes, and I can still hear the sound of that privacy screen sliding shut. Snick, the sound of a door locking, the sound of a career ending, the sound of a partner being made. I am tired, so incredibly tired. But as I lie down in my expensive bed, in my expensive condo, I know that I won't sleep. I will just wait for the sun to come up, so I can go back and do it all again, because that is the deal, and I am a woman who always honors her deals.